Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, October 6, 2022. The new Federal Reserve Board of Governors member Lisa Cook giving her first speech since being confirmed and suggesting, like many of the other Fed board members, there will need to be more interest rate increases to get a handle on high inflation. President Joe Biden and his top economic advisors talking about next steps to try to keep gas prices from climbing after those major oil exporting countries announced production cuts. President saying he is exploring alternatives. North Korea flies its fighter planes near the border of South Korea. It's the latest in the rising tensions that have included the North firing ballistic missiles and the U.S., South Korea, and Japan stepping up military exercises. We'll get the latest from the Pentagon and U.S. State Department. Possible 2024 Republican presidential candidate Maryland Governor Larry Hogan speaking at a traditional candidate stop in New Hampshire called Politics and Eggs, and asked about immigration, and some Republican governors sending migrants from the U.S.-Mexico border to other states. And a governor's race on the high-priority list for both Republicans and Democrats, Kansas. We'll hear from the candidates, incumbent Democrat Governor Laura Kelly and Republican challenger Derek Schmidt, and talk about the contest with Andrew Ball, a senior statehouse reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal and Gannett, Kansas. We start with the Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook giving her first major speech since her confirmation by the U.S. Senate back in May. Today, she talked about supporting the Fed policy of raising interest rates to deal with high inflation and saying more rate hikes will be needed.
Inflation remains stubbornly and unacceptably high. And data over the past few months show that inflationary pressures remain broad-based. My focus, therefore, is on bringing inflation back down to our 2% target. I am heartened to see measures of medium to long-term inflation expectations falling in the surveys from the New York Fed and the University of Michigan. Although those declines may partly reflect falling gasoline prices, they provide some evidence that inflation expectations are well anchored. The data on actual inflation, however, have shown a slower decline than I had anticipated, and I am seeking to better understand the reasons. I am focused on the lag between signs of easing price pressures and actual inflation coming down from its very high levels. Much of the surge in inflation over the past year was rooted in the incomplete recovery of aggregate supply from pandemic-related shutdowns. Global supply chain disruptions had especially wide-reaching effects. This year, Russia's invasion of Ukraine sparked a surge in energy prices and affected global food markets both directly by reducing shipments of commodities such as grain and indirectly by, for example, curtailing fertilizer production. In recent months, some of the upward pressure from these forces has begun to wane. Supply bottlenecks appear to be easing, and global oil and commodity prices have declined. This largely reflects worsening global growth prospects, notably in Europe, which is suffering from the reduced flow of Russian natural gas, and in China with its zero COVID policy and property sector difficulties.
Lisa Cook, member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, today at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. She was confirmed by the Senate back in May on a 51-50 vote, with Vice President Kamala Harris, president of the Senate, breaking the tie between the 50 members of the Democratic caucus and voting yes, and the 50 members of the Republican conference voting no. Lisa Cook, also now the first black woman to serve as a Fed governor. After her speech, the Institute president, Adam Rosen, asking her about how long interest rate increases will be needed to bring down inflation.
As you have, you and your colleagues have focused throughout the recent months on stemming high inflation. You mentioned some of the data points and some of the conflicting data points that are out there. What are some of, to you, the key data points to focus on as you try to figure out whether inflation is slowing enough? Or are you simply going to keep going until inflation actually is at target?
That's a good question. So as I was saying in my speech, I am data dependent. I am willing to alter the course as the data evolve, and I embrace a risk management approach that looks at and considers the baseline projections, but also understands the salient risks. So among the various variables that I mentioned in the speech, let's say wholesale prices for vehicles, but also so traditional high-frequency data, but also real-time data like Google mobility data and OpenTable data. And we certainly want to be able to observe how monetary policy is having an effect on financial conditions and other outcomes we're interested in, particularly inflation. So we're looking at a broad range of indicators, not just one indicator, and I think that's appropriate in a highly uncertain environment.
Lisa Cook, member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. C-SPAN was there. You can find the full program archived at our video library, cspan.org, runs about 40 minutes. Bloomberg News reporting on this writes, Lisa Cook's comments were as resolute on curbing high prices as those made by her colleagues, dashing the hopes some Fed watchers and economists had of hers being a more dovish voice on the policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee. Cook's research into economic inequalities and the impact on growth had led some to believe she might push for a less restrictive pace of tightening so as not to cause large disruptions to the labor market. That from Bloomberg News. President Joe Biden saying today his administration is looking for ways to lower gas prices following yesterday's announcement by the major oil exporting countries known as OPEC Plus that they will cut their production by 2 million barrels per day starting in November, and that's likely to raise gas prices around the world. President Biden speaking to reporters as he left the White House this morning.
Disappointment, and we're looking at what alternatives we may have. Don't hurt him, man. Don't you knock him through the water. There's a lot of alternatives. We haven't made up our mind yet.
At the G20 summit, sir, will you meet President Putin at the G20 summit or APEC summit?
That remains to be seen.
A lot.
No, the trip was not essentially for oil. The trip was about the Middle East and about Israel and rationalization of positions. But it is a disappointment, and it says that there are problems.
President Biden with reporters on the White House lawn, a little noisy as the helicopter, Marine One, in the background, getting ready to take the president off for a trip to New York. But the last question about his trip to Saudi Arabia. Aboard Air Force One during the journey to New York, the director of the White House National Economic Council, Brian Deese, speaking with reporters and getting questions about those alternatives the president spoke about to lower gas prices when he was asked about the oil production cut announcement by the OPEC Plus countries.
the near term with OPEC. Can you talk a little bit about what you see as being sort of at the 30,000 foot level, potential dangers to the U.S. and world economy because of these OPEC cuts? And the president, as he was departing, says there's alternatives. What are the alternatives that are being weighed right now?
So the president's approach, our approach, and our strategy since the since Putin began amassing troops and then and invaded Ukraine has been on trying to maintain sufficient supply of energy, oil and natural gas, globally to maintain to keep prices at a stable and lower level, while also training all of the appropriate pain on Russia and on Putin that is necessary. That has been and continues to be our strategy. As we've said, the OPEC decision, the reason why we were disappointed in it is we believe it's unnecessary and unwarranted at a period where, if you look at the global energy picture and the oil picture, the lack of supply continues to be a significant challenge. We're going to have to see the actual impact of this, and I think it's I wouldn't fully speculate. As you all know, the difference between the headline of what the OPEC members announced yesterday with respect to their quotas and the actual impact on production is something that we'll have to see in the market, and certainly the impact on production will be significantly lower than that that headline that they announced. But to your question about alternatives, we identified some of these and we'll continue to focus on them, right? If you look at the U.S., where we are in the U.S. right now, the wholesale price for gasoline, refined gasoline, is about, on average across the country, about $1.20 lower than the retail price that consumers are paying. Historically, that gap has been about 90 cents. So in the very near term, what we believe needs to happen, consistent with market principles, is that the energy companies need to reduce retail prices to reflect the price that they're paying for the wholesale gas. And the reason why wholesale gas prices continue to be at that level is because of all of the progress that we've made. Oil and gas prices are moving around, but they are significantly lower now than they were a couple of months ago. So that's the first thing. The other measures are things that are on the table and we continue to look at. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is one of those. So, you know, we're not announcing any steps on that front, but there are measures that we will continue to assess as we go forward.
Brian Deese is director of the National Economic Council at the White House, speaking to reporters on Air Force One. A story from ABC News. The U.S. is set to produce an average of 11.8 million barrels of oil per day in 2022, which stands 500,000 barrels short of a record set in 2019, according to the Energy Information Administration. But oil prices are set on a global market where the OPEC Plus cuts cannot be offset by a comparable short-term increase in U.S. oil output. ABC News article also has this. The average price of a U.S. gallon of gas is $3.86, according to AAA data. That price marks a 2% rise from a month ago and 20% rise from a year ago. In California, the state with the highest average gas price, a gallon costs $6.42. President Biden today traveling to Poughkeepsie, New York, to visit an IBM campus, speaking about IBM's pledge of $20 billion invested in R&D and computer chip manufacturing across the Hudson Valley region of New York over the next 10 years. President saying that the bill he recently signed into law, Chips and Science Act, directly led IBM to launch this initiative.
Here in the United States, one-third of the core inflation last year, was due to higher prices of automobiles. Why? Because of the shortage of semiconductors that make these vehicles move. Folks, we need to make these chips here in America to bring down everyday cost and create good-paying American jobs. And don't take my word for it. Listen to the leaders of IBM and across the country. They're making decisions right now about where to invest to produce these chips. And they're choosing America because they see we're coming back. We're leading the way. As I said, since I came to office, our economy has created 10 million jobs, 668 manufacturing jobs. Proof that made in America is no longer a slogan. It's a reality. And the Chips and Science Act makes historic investment in companies to build advanced manufacturing facilities here in America.
President Biden at the IBM factory in Poughkeepsie, New York. Wall Street today, the Dow down 346, NASDAQ down 75, S&P down 38. North Korea flying a dozen of its warplanes near the border with South Korea, leading South Korea today to scramble about 30 of its military planes in response. This all comes after North Korea fired two more ballistic missiles into the sea, its sixth round of missile tests in less than 2 weeks. And that comes as the U.S., South Korea, and Japanese militaries are conducting joint drills, and the U.S. has redeployed an aircraft carrier to the area. More from the Pentagon today. Question to the press secretary, Pat Ryder.
North Koreans have also flown fighter jets and bombers near the border, which prompted another response from South Korea. Today, they flew, I guess, another 30 aircraft in response. What does the department think of this sort of ratcheting up of tensions in the area? Does this suggest tensions are higher than they have been in quite some time? Does this sort of suggest that there could be an ICBM test or some sort of nuclear test from North Korea coming? What is the U.S. assessment of these actions?
Well, sure. Overall, as I've mentioned, we consider this behavior destabilizing, unhelpful, and irresponsible. And again, we call on the DPRK to cease these types of actions. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, our focus continues to be on consulting closely with our allies in the region, to include South Korea and Japan, on how to best and most appropriately respond to these types of actions. And so in the days ahead, we'll continue to do that.
Well, does the U.S. see moving the ships into that region as further provoking North Korea to do something more?
I don't want to speak for North Korea in terms of what may or may not be causing them to respond this way. I am aware of their public statements on the matter. Regardless, our focus in the region, these are actions that we announce in advance. They're actions that we have implemented as part of a defense in support of our allies in the region. Again, we'll continue to focus on those areas and would hope that North Korea would also have the best interests of the region and peace and stability as well. Thank you.
The Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder, also an Air Force Brigadier General, with reporters in the Pentagon briefing room. At the United Nations, this from Reuters, the United States asked the UN Security Council to meet on North Korea on Wednesday after Pyongyang fired a ballistic missile over Japan, but diplomats said China and Russia are opposed to a public discussion by the 15-member body. More on that from today's State Department briefing. Question from Associated Press reporter Matt Lee to the principal deputy spokesperson, Vedant Patel.
In the past, you have managed to get an international consensus. You mentioned the Security Council resolutions, that they're in violation of all those were passed. But yesterday, we saw a situation where the Russians and the Chinese blocked any kind of meaningful action. Are you at all hindered in trying to get the North Koreans back to the negotiating table by the position that the Russians and the Chinese are taking? Or do you think that you can, actions that you take on your own or in concert with allies, can be enough to do it?
Well, first, to echo our UN ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, on Russia and China's actions during the Security Council meeting yesterday, that was obviously deeply disappointing. And we saw the very loose use of rhetoric that the DPRK's actions were provoked or something to that effect. That obviously and certainly is not the case. But look, Matt, to take a little bit of a bigger step back, our goal here still remains the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Dialogue with the DPRK without preconditions continues to be, in our viewpoint, a piece to that puzzle. And so we're going to continue to pursue those things. However, we also are going to continue to hold the DPRK accountable through actions at our multilateral institutions and other actions otherwise. I don't have anything to preview, but again, we have been reacting and we've been taking action to this directly. Kylie?
I'm wondering if the administration expects that North Korea will carry out a nuclear test before the end of the year, because administration officials were very clear in saying it was possible that they could be preparing for one when the president was in Asia earlier this year. They didn't actually carry out a nuclear test. Do you think it'll happen before the end of the year?
Like I said, we're still assessing the specific nature, and I don't have a new or different assessment to provide from here. But I think the bigger thing is that we, again, condemn these very destabilizing and unsafe actions that we're seeing come from the DPRK over the course of this week.
Vedant Patel, Principal Deputy State Department Spokesman, with reporters in the State Department briefing room, getting questions about North Korea or the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Some developments in Russia's war in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appealing to the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, to denounce Russian President Vladimir Putin's declaration unilaterally that Russia now owns the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, the largest power plant in Europe. And Russia firing missiles into residential buildings in the city of Zaporizhia near the plant, killing a number of people. Also targeting with missiles five other cities in Ukraine. This is Ukrainian forces continue to retake Ukrainian territory in the east and south that had been held by the Russian invasion. In Washington, D.C., a Ukrainian major general, who's also the embassy defense attaché, taking part in a discussion hosted by the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He was asked what weapons Ukraine needs in the next 6 to 12 months to keep up the fight.
7 months ago, before when war started, and when we were looking for capabilities like HIMARS or even 155 howitzers, the answer was no. Because everyone believed that Ukraine is going to give up in 3 days. And we received javelins, stingers, small arms and weapons for guerrilla warfare. When the world saw Bucha atrocities, we received 155, which was a game changer on the ground because the range is higher than Russian artillery, and we managed to fight with good results with Russian artillery. Then later in spring, we received HIMARS, which was really game changer. With HIMARS, with a distance of 80 kilometers, we managed to destroy a lot of Russian C2, ammunition depot, logistics, and everything on the temporary occupied Ukrainian territory. In this way, we cut Russian forces from supply chain and so on. What we are, as we advance now, what we are looking, what capabilities we are looking in the future. We still looking for artillery. Probably self-propelled is more effective. We are looking for rounds like Excalibur, which are very effective. Thanks to our partners, we receive some of them, and they're very effective. We are looking for long-range missiles for HIMARS, which still we need to hit some targets on the occupied Ukrainian territory. We are looking in future. We are going to shift, in any case, to another fighter jets. We are moving to switch to Western type of other equipment, like armored vehicles or tanks. Plus, we can produce a lot ourselves. And the way ahead, it's to create joint ventures or something like this with Ukrainian defense industry, which was capable to produce satellites, ballistic missiles, and so on in the some past. So that is the way ahead to obtain this kind of capabilities.
Ukrainian Major General Boris Kremenetsky, who's also the Ukrainian Embassy Defense Attaché to the U.S., at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. Washington Today continues in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now video app and wherever you get your podcasts. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, considered by some to be a potential presidential candidate as early as 2024, returned to New Hampshire on Thursday. That's the opening line from an article at WMUR-TV's website. It continues, Governor Hogan addressed a crowd at the latest installment of the Politics and Eggs Breakfast at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College and touted some of his accomplishments as governor, citing tax cuts and improved safety. Governor Hogan didn't commit to running for president once his gubernatorial term ends in January, though, but he said whether or not he runs, he'll aim to get the Republican Party, quote, back to winning elections again. That reporting from WMUR. C-SPAN covered this program in Manchester. It's co-sponsored by the New England Council. It's President James Brett asking the governor a question about immigration.
One of the most pressing issues that we just can't seem to get our arms around and trying to find a solution is immigration. Some of your fellow governors in other parts of the country have taken immigration to a higher level and sending some of the newly arrived immigrants to different parts of this country. Your thoughts on how we can address this issue? There are some people out there that believe that the issue is more important than the solution. Just keep the issue alive. Your thoughts on how we can seriously address the issue. And what do you think of your colleagues, of other governors, Texas, Florida, using this immigration issue?
Well, obviously, immigration is a huge issue and problem that has been not been addressed by either party or by any of our leaders for a long time. I mean, I was a chairman of Youth for Reagan back in 1980, and I can tell you that Reagan talked about fixing immigration. And we've been talking about it ever since. It doesn't matter who's in charge of Congress or who the president is. It's something that we all agree is a problem and an issue, but we don't seem to come up with any kind of a bipartisan common sense solution. And I think most people would agree that we need a secure border to begin with, and we've got to stop, you know, open borders and having, you know, human trafficking and dangerous drugs and people crossing the border is not the answer. That's some of my Democratic friends think that's the answer. Republicans are demonizing the issue. And look, I think we've got to secure the border and then find a pathway to citizenship. We've got to look at a process that we have huge shortages in certain workforce problems in industries all across America that we could solve by trying to fix that immigration problem and bringing in the people we actually need to do jobs that Americans don't want. I think it's a mistake. I talked to my governor colleagues about this. I did join in with 23 other governors with a border strike force to try to secure the border because I think the federal government is failing in that regard. But I thought it was a mistake to, you know, basically, I think, do publicity stunts of busing people out of from the border up to other states. And I know, you know, I said, you know, they put thousands of them in Washington, D.C., which is right next to my state. And I reminded my colleagues that we didn't have Border Patrol at the Maryland DC line and that they were dropping these thousands of folks in buses. They were crossing into my state, and it was now a problem I had to deal with rather than them. And I know Governor DeSantis, who had nothing to do with the issue, when, you know, after Governor Abbott was doing it in Texas, he went to Texas and basically, grab 50 people and send them to Martha's Vineyard as a publicity stunt. And I think it was a terrible idea. Let's just, try to address the issue seriously and fix the problem rather than trying to get on TV. It's back to what I was saying earlier about the performative politics. It's not a serious discussion. It's not a good solution.
Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, a Republican, at the Politics and Eggs breakfast at St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire this morning. Politics and Eggs is a series that attracts possible presidential contenders. Since New Hampshire is still the first in the nation presidential primary state for the Republicans, it may not be for the Democrats starting in 2024. One of the closely watched governor's races this year is in Kansas. The incumbent Laura Kelly, a Democrat, challenged by Republican Derek Schmidt, who is currently the state attorney general. Cook Political Report rates this as a toss-up. In a couple of minutes, we'll talk with a Kansas government reporter from Topeka about this election. First, here's a question to the candidates at a debate on Wednesday.
What, in your judgment, Governor Kelly, is the most serious threat currently facing the state of Kansas?
Well, actually the most serious threat right now is probably a workforce shortage. As I've gone all around the state, we just finished up our Prosperity on the Plains tour, and no matter where I went, it was workforce, it was housing, it was affordable childcare, and it was water. And those are the kinds of things that Kansans are thinking about. Those are the kinds of things that my administration is working on to resolve. We actually, because of the economic success that we have had, bringing in $14 billion of new economic development, 51,000 newer retained jobs, we have actually exacerbated some of those problems. But you can trust that we have got all eyes on, and we are working like the devil to ensure that we meet those challenges of workforce, housing, and childcare.
And Derek Schmidt, the biggest threat facing Kansas for you is blank.
Well, I think it's a couple of things. Certainly there are many serious problems facing our state, and we have to have an all-of-the-above approach to dealing with them. But I do think that the flow of drugs across the southern border of the United States, that it's been methamphetamine that's been king for many years, it is now deadly fentanyl that is in our communities. It is mostly manufactured in precursor chemicals in China and south of the border, shipped into Kansas and distributed by drug cartels. It is killing our children. And the federal administration right now under President Biden's leadership will not address it. They will not secure the southern border of the United States, which transforms what was a national border security or immigration issue into a public health and public safety issue for moms and dads and families right here in Johnson County and around this state.
30 seconds to rebut, Laura Kelly.
Yeah, no doubt I believe that we need secure borders. But if we really want to deal with the fentanyl issue and other substance abuse issues facing our state, then we need to finally, once and for all, expand Medicaid so that people can access the services that they need to deal with the issues that they're suffering from.
Final word to you, Derek Schmidt.
Well, I've helped with other of my colleagues, lead the national effort to hold drug companies accountable for their opioid addiction that they peddled for profit. We are bringing $200 million into this state over the next several years in order to specifically address substance abuse issues and addiction issues. But at the end of the day, we must stop the flood on the supply side. And while the governor says she supports a secure southern border, she has taken no action and said scarcely few words on what that means to her.
Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, Democrat, running for re-election, debating Republican challenger Derek Schmidt, who is the Attorney General, Wednesday at a debate hosted by Kansas City PBS. Andrew Ball, senior statehouse reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal and Gannett, Kansas, has been following the campaign for Kansas governor and joins us now by phone. Thank you very much. You write about Wednesday night's debate. Polls have deemed the race a toss-up, adding a new sense of urgency to the showdown between the two candidates in a suburban Kansas City ballroom. What were your takeaways from that debate?
Yeah, so this is, for those who haven't been tracking this race super closely, this has been a big priority for both sides nationally, one of the top three pickup opportunities for Republicans and one of the top three priorities for Democrats to defend. And I think that we are really starting to, like I said, we're starting to see a new sense of urgency where last night, both candidates spent a lot of time talking about two people that are not on the ballot in November, Republican Attorney General Derek Schmidt, really trying to tie Governor Laura Kelly to President Joe Biden and taking her to task for high government spending that he thinks has brought about inflation. At the same time, Governor Kelly has been trying to tie the attorney general to former Governor Sam Brownback. Now, folks from across the country may remember Governor Brownback's tenure was defined by a failed attempt to cut taxes, a tax experiment that did many things, but resulted in major issues in providing government services, public education, public safety, and is not a time that a lot of people remember fondly. So the governor really trying to say that a vote for Derek Schmidt would bring Kansas back into that era.
When it comes to the issues that Kansans have been focusing on, has it been the economic issues or maybe some of the cultural issues as they talk about them?
Yeah, so we've seen definitely bits of both. I mean, it's the economy, stupid. That has been the number one thing both candidates, I think, have been talking about. The governor really touting her work on economic development. Kansas is going to get a big project building electric vehicle batteries. That's going to be about a $4 billion investment. Really saying, hey, another 4 years is going to be more projects like that and more jobs for Kansas. The attorney general, like I said, is saying, inflation is up and we need, real tax relief. We need new ideas to combat that. But there also has been a lot of talk on some of these cultural issues, the culture war issues, so to speak. Derek Schmidt really has been going hard after the governor for twice vetoing a ban on transgender athletes in girls and women's sports. So much so that the governor had a bit of an attempt to respond that has gotten a fair amount of fire, where she kind of made it seem like she supports a transgender athletes ban, but is in a very carefully worded ad that kind of brought this issue back up again. So we're definitely seeing a mix, but not so much on abortion, which, folks may remember Kansas had a big vote on abortion in the August primary to reject a constitutional amendment that could have really restricted abortion rights. Neither candidate really has been talking about that so much that we've seen.
We're talking with Andrew Ball from the Topeka Capital Journal. One of the issues that you highlight in your article at cjonline.com is medical marijuana. Is this controversial in Kansas? There are so many other states that have legalized marijuana.
Yeah, it is a big issue here. And part of the reason is geography. Oklahoma and Missouri have medical marijuana. Colorado has recreational marijuana. And Nebraska and Missouri actually have ballot initiatives in the fall for recreational and medical marijuana. And the worry is that whether we like it or not, Kansas is falling behind. Only a few states have no form of legalized medical marijuana, and Kansas is one of them. And we're starting to see some change. 2021, two legislative sessions ago, the Kansas House, for the first time ever, passed a medical marijuana bill. Now, that's gotten stuck in the wheels of the legislative process, but whoever is the next governor will probably be have this issue on their plate and potentially could have it fall to them to kind of shepherd in, a medical marijuana program. So their positions on this issue really are quite important as Kansas, is looking at whether or not we should be playing catch up on this or not.
We started by talking about how the polls for the governor's race are close. If you look at the Kansas congressional delegation, it is almost entirely Republican. There's just one Democrat there. Why is the governor's race competitive?
Yeah, so Kansas is weird, is the short answer to your question. But, 4 years ago, voters in Kansas really wanted change. Governor Kelly was running against a very conservative opponent, former Secretary of State Kris Kobach. And, the playbook for Democrats in Kansas is that they can sometimes win, but they have to be very particular in the issues they focus on. they have to be a bit more moderate. They have to really talk about those pocketbook issues and not fall into the trap of talking about national politics. And the governor has really tried to follow this mold. And I think that's why you're seeing that she maybe has a bit more traction here than you otherwise would expect. You know, folks think of Kansas, they think of Bob Dole and what's the matter with Kansas, and they think of a very conservative state. And the truth is a bit more nuanced. And, you know, you mentioned the congressional races. We see that with Congresswoman Sharice Davids as well. Democrats can find success here. Just, you know, there's a playbook they have to follow in order to do so.
Andrew Ball is a senior State House reporter with the Topeka Capital Journal and Gannett News. Find his articles at cjonline.com and on Twitter. He's at Andrew Ball, B-A-H-L. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We spoke with that reporter about the issue of legalizing medical marijuana in Kansas. Today, President Joe Biden pardoning anyone with a prior federal offense of simple marijuana possession. Administration officials believe that will benefit thousands of Americans, also pardoning thousands more convicted of that simple possession in the District of Columbia. President Biden in a statement saying sending people to prison for possessing marijuana has upended too many lives and incarcerated people for conduct that many states no longer prohibit. Criminal records for marijuana possession have also imposed needless barriers to employment, housing, and educational opportunities. President Biden calling on governors to issue similar pardons for those convicted of state marijuana offenses. That's the vast majority of cases in the nation. Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming spoke at the McCain Institute at Arizona State University's campus in Tempe Wednesday night, urging voters in Arizona not to vote for the Republican nominees for governor, Carrie Lake, and Secretary of State, Mark Finchem. Congresswoman Cheney said those candidates are putting the nation's democratic system at risk by repeating former President Donald Trump's lies that he won the 2020 presidential election.
I'd love to start by talking about the current moment that we find ourselves in. We're defending a free and fair election in the United States of America in the year 2022 is considered courageous. Liz Cheney is on everybody's mind. I'd love to know what's on your mind. What are you thinking about as you continue to work each day to defend our democracy in the face of ongoing domestic threats?
Well, I spend a lot of time thinking about Arizona. If you think about elections that are happening now, in Arizona today, you have a candidate for governor in Carrie Lake. You have a candidate for Secretary of State in Mark Finchem, both of whom have said, this isn't a surprise, it's not a secret, they've both said that they will only honor the results of an election if they agree with it. Both of them have looked at 2020. They've looked at the fact that the election here in Arizona was carried out according to state law, that there were counts, that there were recounts, that there were audits, that there were multiple court cases and rulings, all of which went against the former president. The election itself was certified, and the Arizona electors were correctly certified for Biden. They've looked at all of that, the law, the facts, and the rulings of the courts, and they've said it doesn't matter to them. And if you care about democracy and you care about the survival of our republic, then you need to understand, we all have to understand that we cannot give people power who have told us that they will not honor elections. Elections are the foundation of our republic, and peaceful transfers of power are the foundation of our republic. And we must have elected officials in both parties who understand and honor that duty and that responsibility. So what happens here in Arizona is not just important for Arizona, but it's important for the nation and for the future functioning of our constitutional republic.
Absolutely. Yes.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming at the McCain Institute at Arizona State University in Tempe on Wednesday night. The congresswoman lost her re-election primary over the summer to a candidate supported by former President Trump. And the former president plans to campaign in Arizona this weekend for those two Republican candidates that were mentioned, for governor and for secretary of state. Congresswoman Cheney, also vice chair of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And today the committee announced its next hearing. It'll be Thursday, October 13th, 1 p.m. Eastern. We will, of course, have live complete coverage on the C-SPAN networks. Former President Trump speaking Wednesday at the National Hispanic Leadership Conference in Miami that was hosted by the America First Policy Institute. Part of his speech talked about the ongoing Justice Department investigation into possible mishandling of classified documents, which were seized in a court-authorized FBI search of the former president's home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida.
Just look at how every other president has been treated when they left office. They've been given all the time needed and complete deference when it came to their documents and their papers. No other president has been harassed and persecuted like we have. I speak on behalf of you, too. Barack Hussein Obama moved more than 20 truckloads, over 33 million pages of papers, classified and unclassified, to a poorly built and totally unsafe former furniture store with no security whatsoever. Bill Clinton took millions and millions of documents from the White House to his home in Arkansas. No security. Then it was reported that NARA, you know what NARA is? National Archives, you know that. NARA, which is a radical left-run agency, I don't know if you know that, radical left, seriously radical left, lost a whole hard drive of information from the Clinton White House. Ooh, I wonder what was on there. Lost is in quotes, quote, it lost. They're still searching for it. This is many years ago. They're still searching for it, but you can just imagine. And NARA is so woke and broken that they even placed a warning label on, of all things, the Constitution of the United States.
Former President Donald Trump, Wednesday in Miami at the National Hispanic Leadership Conference hosted by the America First Policy Institute. This from NBC News, Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, who frequently clashed with former President Trump but won a second term in 2020, is expected to resign before the end of the year. A source familiar with the move confirmed to NBC News on Thursday. Senator Sasse expected to exit the Senate to take a new job leading the University of Florida, the source said. The senator and the university confirmed that Senator Sasse is in talks for the top job there after news broke on Thursday. And from the Washington Times, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin on Thursday signed off on a plan to strip any mention of the Confederacy from U.S. military bases, including renaming the Army's legendary Fort Bragg and Fort Hood. He said the changes would be implemented as soon as possible. The report that recommends the cancellation of all references to Confederate figures arrived at Mr. Austin's desk 18 months after Congress mandated a naming commission to review the issue. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to you every day. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.